Today on Pilgrim Radio's His People, Justin Bailey, on helping us understand the importance of culture and engaging it from a Christian perspective.
Then that gives us security to go and sit down at any table, you know, to sit down, to go into any hostile situation and be hospitable. Because the thing that grounds us and the thing that gives us courage and humility is that same place that Jesus ministered from.
Justin Bailey, next. Dr. Justin Bailey wants to help us understand culture and how it shapes our lives and connects or disconnects us from God and our neighbors. In his new book, Interpreting Your World, he explores five dimensions of culture and shows how each needs the others, and they all need theology. Dr. Justin Bailey is a theology professor at Dort University. Justin, tell us what's behind the book.
Yeah, Interpreting Your World is a book that puts together these two worlds that I research, that I serve in, which is this world of culture and this world of theology. So I'm a professor of theology here, but I've always been drawn to the diversity of culture, the complexity of culture. And part of that is being bicultural myself, a Filipino American, and the desire to integrate things and to join people across distances and divides. Another part of it is my desire as a minister of the gospel to share the gospel and to make sure that it sounds like good news to people. And so this book is my attempt to put these two worlds together so that those who seek to live in the world and seek to navigate the complexity of culture with the integrity and vitality of the Christian faith can do that in a way that is not thin and anxious and reductive, but a way that is faithful and thick and curious, but also grounded in Scripture.
What do you mean by five lenses? I realize this is kind of the crux of the book, and I want to come back to this as we talk, but can you give us a little bit of an outline?
So a lens is something that we look through. You sort of think of when you go to the eye doctor and they're, you know, they have, I think it's called a photoropter, that they turn it number one or number two, and or a microscope. You know, if you have a microscope and you have different levels of magnification. And the five lenses that I've chosen in this book are five paradigms or five themes that we can focus on when we talk about the conversation between theology and culture. And so they are meaning and power, ethics, religion, and aesthetics. And in a sense, I'm looking at how the cultural conversation and how the theological conversations kind of unite to be interested in these things. So we are hungry for meaning. We desire beauty. We long for justice. We are incurably religious. And so all of these sort of five themes are not the same thing, though. And I was troubled because a lot of times when I see Christians talking about culture, it seems to me like maybe in out of a desire to kind of focus on something simple, we sometimes reduce it down and miss the complexity and some of the nuance. And so a lot of times, for example, I'll see people only using the power lens when they try to understand culture, or maybe only using the ethical lens. You know, what should we do? And I want to say those lenses are important and we need to look through those lenses. But if we only use one of those lenses, then the description that we give of culture and the way that we live in the world will be reductive. And the saying goes, if you only have a hammer, everything looks like a nail. And so I'm just trying to give five different tools or five different lenses, five different approaches to engaging culture.
I think in your book, you say it's sort of like looking through a kaleidoscope. If anybody knows what that means anymore, I mean, at least the older generation does. Can you talk about that a little bit?
So I think that in keeping with that, I was taught to interact with culture as a text when I was in seminary, and that was really helpful. You know, the person who taught that to me wrote the foreword for the book. But any metaphor that we use for understanding culture is going to be limited. Any metaphor, you know, makes us think about the world in a certain way. And so rather than getting rid of that idea of interpreting culture as a text, meaning that you're, you know, in the same way that you interpret scripture, you're trying to figure out what it means and how you should respond to it. The thing about thinking about culture as a text is something that is separate from me, and I can sort of decide whether or not I want to be engaged with it or not. And so I'm saying, by saying it's more than a text, is I don't have a choice whether or not I'm involved with culture. I am a cultural being. God created me to be a cultural being. I'm speaking a particular language. I live in a particular place. My imagination has been formed by particular things. And so what I'm trying to do by placing these other five or other four metaphors next to the metaphor of text is to show that, you know, sort of like a diamond, you can hold this up and look at it from different angles. It's the same diamond, but if you only look at it from one angle, then you miss the beautiful complexity of what culture is.
And I suppose we should define culture.
It is one of the hardest words to define. It always makes me laugh that there is a 1957 book that was written that had 52 different definitions of culture. So I'm not going to give you all 52, but let me give you three.
Okay.
Three W's. So first of all, culture is a world we inhabit, a world of meaning. It's sort of like walking in a force field. You know, you can sort of feel the pull of certain things on you. We could also think of it as a field in which we're planted. And in our cultural field, certain ideas grow and certain ideas don't grow very well. So it's a world. It's a whole world of meaning. Second, cultural, it's a work. It's something that we do unintentionally. So we can't not do it. We can't not make culture. This is how God created us, you know, to go out and take the good start that He gave us in creation and have dominion and rule and make things of culture. So culture is a verb in that sense. It's something we do. So it's something we inhabit. That's the first sense. It's something we do, the second sense. And then the third sense is related to the second sense, and that culture is a web that we weave in which so it kind of puts both of them together, that it's a web that we weave so that we can live a life that is meaningful and vital, and for Christians, fitting with the gospel of Jesus Christ and the scriptures. And so this is a very intentional thing. So when we talk about cultivating communities or cultivating a teacher, I'll talk about cultivating a classroom or cultivating relationships or cultivating a church. This is the sort of culture that we actually get to intentionally make. And I really invested in this idea that it's not enough for us simply to critique and to resist. We have to also build something beautiful. We have to weave a beautiful web that corresponds to what we see in the Christian faith. And so that those are the three kind of working definitions: culture as world, culture as work, culture as web.
And you have the dominant culture, obviously, that we're all part of, regardless of, in one sense, whatever our ethnicity might be, or our job, our profession, and there are many subcultures as well.
That's right. Yeah. So that's where you have what we might call popular culture, mm-hmm. That's the thing that kind of has some unifying power, you know, across local cultures. In some sense, that's a tragedy, that popular culture flattens some of those distinctive nuances of local cultures. But for better or for worse, those are the facts on the ground, that we all live in this place where mass media has elevated certain perspectives and certain voices. And in some sense, I find myself trying to read the news, and all of a sudden I'm reading celebrity news, and I think, why am I reading about this person that I don't actually care about? And right. It's because, well, I mean, I'm thrown into that world, mm-hmm. and it's very difficult to avoid. That's what I mean when I say that it's this field of force in which you have to be really thoughtful as you navigate it. It's sort of like in the book of Proverbs, when you have wisdom and folly calling to the young person, whoever is simple, come in here. You know, we always move through this world in which there are these cultural voices calling out to us. And some of them are saying things that are helpful. Some of the things are saying that are not helpful, that you know, might lead to destruction. And so to hear the voice of wisdom, the voice that tells us what we cannot tell ourselves, which is the interest of theology, and to kind of walk through the city, you know, walk through the that place where we're hearing all these voices, feeling all these forces, and again, to do that with humility, to do that with charity, but to do that with integrity.
And as you talk about navigating that, it reminds me of Jesus' words, where he says his disciples are to be in the world, but not of the world.
Yeah, that's right. At the end of the book, I note, you know, this idea that we have in Jesus's ministry, that Jesus is so compassionate, right? He's willing to join anyone at their table. So whether that is people that everyone labeled as sinners or the Pharisees who were judging him the entire time, you know, and Jesus is willing to sit down at anyone's table. And that's kind of a reverse way of thinking about hospitality, the willing to go into a situation where you're not really the one in control. And they might judge you, you know, they might, you know, not like you or whatever, but Jesus' ministry is fueled by his sense that he is the beloved son of the Father. And because he knows the Father's love for him, you know, he says things to the Pharisees like, you know, it doesn't matter what you say about me, I only do the things that please the Father. So the Father's will is sort of the lodestar, the guiding light of his ministry. Everything he does is motivated not by being reactionary to what people are saying or doing, but by what the Father wants him to do. And I'm hoping that the same sort of grounded sense that if we know that we are secure, not because we have all the answers or anything like that, or because of our cultural success, but because we know that God has promised to be faithful to us, then that gives us a security to go and sit down at any table, you know, to sit down and to go into any hostile situation and be hospitable. Because the thing that grounds us and the thing that gives us courage and humility is that same place that Jesus ministered from.
And in terms of the idea of being culturally literate, I think you reference that in your book and you hear of that. What is involved in that?
And so I think that that work of being cultural literate begins with recognizing the ways that culture, that we are already invested in culture, the way that culture has already shaped us. And as I say in the book, you know, your interpretation is not just what you think about culture, it's the life you live within a cultural space. Your interpretation is your life. And that's true of scripture, of course. Your interpretation of a passage is not, you know, what you think about it so much as the way that you respond to it, whether you obey it, whether you live it out. In the same way with culture, your interpretation of culture, you know, my interpretation of the smartphone is what do I do with it, you know, when I go through the world, you know, when I'm in the presence of my children. What do I do with it when I wake up in the middle of the night and can't sleep? Do I turn to that for solace? You know, that's my interpretation of culture. And so I think that cultural literacy, as you say, does begin with us recognizing the ways that we are already culturally invested and the ways that we are in some ways enmeshed, and I would even say in some cases entrapped by particular cultural streams. And then allowing that work of discernment to start with us.
Well, the book is Interpreting Your World, Five Lenses for Engaging Theology and Culture. You have a quote in your book, Justin, my guest, Dr. Justin Bailey. He's the author of the book. And that is, the world needs faithful and creative conversationalists rooted in the wisdom of theology, yet hospitable to the wisdom of culture. Kind of bringing those two together in the subtitle of your book. And I think people often wonder, okay, how do I apply this to my life? You're saying, well, it applies as you interact with, as you talk with, as you have conversations with other people.
Yeah, cultural wisdom, if you think about, for example, wisdom in the book of Proverbs, it is the result of paying careful attention, right? The sages observe the world. They look at the way that things work, the grooves of creation. So they're learning from ants, you know, insects, you know, in the book of Proverbs, and they're willing to receive wisdom wherever they find it, but then they place that under the fear of the Lord. The fear of Yahweh is the beginning of wisdom. And so that's what I mean about being hospitable to the wisdom of culture. There's this great passage in Isaiah 2 where it talks about the farmers planting their crops in rows, and then it says, their God teaches them, or their God has taught them to do that. And so you think about that. Well, that's not really true, is it? Isn't it actually the case that the farmer learned from, you know, their family or some apprenticeship? And yet, biblically, there's this sense that cultural wisdom, that careful observation of the way that the world works, that's passed down within cultures and within communities, is one of the ways that God reveals things about creation to us. And so we have to have patient and discerning eyes to see the wisdom that is actually found in the world around us as people who are made in God's image and confronted with God's presence, wrestle with reality, you know. And so we shouldn't be surprised to find wisdom there. But we want that. We don't want that to be the place where our deepest roots are. We want our deepest roots to be in this biblical story of creation and fall and redemption, and that our security would be found not in, again, our ability to fix everything necessarily, but in the confidence that God is at work in the world, and we are called to faithfully contribute to what God is doing, to take the situation we're in, and to, as a friend of mine says, leave it better than we found it, at least. And that's our calling. That's our joyful calling, is to join God in the work that God is doing.
It's interesting that you mentioned a story, and it seems like when you talk about the culture that we live in, the world around us, it's the telling of stories that seems to capture people's hearts, whether it's in films or in books or in music or in art or in the media, as you said, stories of celebrities and sports have their own story, things like that. And people tend to, I think you write in your book, people tend to see those kind of cultural artifacts, that kind of thing, as gripping the heart, whereas theology tends to be a matter of the head, of the mind, but not so much of the heart. But can you help us understand how theology can be a matter of the heart, and we can engage the culture maybe more effectively?
Yeah, I think that in some ways it represents some of the ways that we've gone wrong in the way that we talk about theology or talk about our faith, because God created us as these narrative creatures, right? We all find ourselves in between a past that we can't change and a future we can't control. And so we naturally link events, right? We build a narrative from past to present to future, so that what happened in the past forms us for the present and the present prepares us for the future. And so we can't not do that because of the way that we are created to live in time. And then when you look at the way that God has, again, given us his word, it also is the predominant. I mean, there's lots of genres within it, but it's a story, right? That starts at the very beginning and goes to the very end. And we are given stories so that we might find our place within God's story. God did not give us a book of 501 facts about God, right? Here's 501 bullet points. And there's a reason why God doesn't do that, because bullet points might be just received as information, whereas a story invites you to use your imagination and to place yourself within it. There's lots of things that happen in the world that the Bible doesn't explicitly speak about, you know, whether those are technological advances or situational things that happen in families. And so that requires some imagination to go from the sacred page and the meta-narrative of Scripture to say, now, what does it mean for me to live faithfully in this situation if the world is the way that God says it is, in terms of created, loved by God, badly damaged by sin, but yet being renewed and healed because of what Jesus Christ has done? Now, that requires a different sort of imagination to think of theology that way. And I think if we were able to think about theology that way and think about our faith in that more narrative model, that actually it would connect with who we really are as people. We're not just brains on a stick, right? We are imagining, desiring, loving, hoping narrative creatures who consume culture in ways that fit the narrative, the stories we tell ourselves, right? And sometimes the stories we tell ourselves are not very good stories. Mm-hmm. The stories we've believed are not good stories. And we need not just to, you will only reject that smaller story if you were given a bigger and better and more beautiful story in which to live. And I think that's exactly what Christian faith offers. That's what the gospel offers. And so that's what I'm trying to do in this book, in the sense, is to kind of walk alongside and hear the cultural stories and then ask, are there ways that the theology, so again, this is God coming from the outside and telling us what we could never have discovered on our own, we could never have reached on our own, we could never have told ourselves. It has to be revealed. It has to come from the outside. And because it comes from the outside, it always brings a critique. But it also then tries to work its way into the very heart of things, so that our deepest hopes and deepest dreams are not replaced, but transfigured and fulfilled.
Well, the book is Interpreting Your World, Five Lenses for Engaging Theology and Culture. My guest is Dr. Justin Bailey. Getting to those five lenses, and I realize that we only We'll be able to look at each one briefly, hopefully, in the time we have left, Justin. But the five lenses or five dimensions, the meaning dimension, the power dimension, the ethical dimension, the religious dimension, and the aesthetic dimension. I'm wondering if you could tell us just how a little bit about what's involved or how to see the culture through the meaning dimension or culture as, I think you say culture as immune system.
Yeah, culture as immune system. Now, this, of course, was a metaphor that was near at hand, given everything that's been happening in the last few years. We are thinking about our immune systems quite a bit, you know, more than we might have done, you know, 3 years ago. And I use this because I wanted to capture something of the way that culture is contagious, that it's not something that's taught so much as caught. We get kind of like we catch a virus or we catch, you know, a bug, and it's not that we have no choice or no agency, but there are certain things that just resonate with us and take up refuge in our, what I call, cultural immune system. And then there are other things that we are very resistant to, you know? So for example, within, you know, my context and in American culture, individualism is a really, really strong value. And so there is some resistance to some of, yeah, the biblical injunctions to community and interdependence and things like that. And so we just kind of resist that naturally. When it comes to us, it feels like a threat, you know, something that, you know, we don't connect to as readily. Whereas there are other ideas that really do connect, you know, really, really readily to, you know, the cultural context that we're in. And so meaning is this sense that we're always looking for connection. We're looking to find stability and security. And so culture as a meaning-making system or as a web of meaning or as an immune system is this sense of, yeah, wanting to be safe and wanting to be stable. And because of that, we tend to resist and react against things that destabilizes or that decenter us or that whatever that might be.
Well, the next dimension to interpret our world, to help us engage theology and culture, the power dimension, culture is power play.
Yeah. So, I mean, one of the most undeniable or maybe undeniable because it's so prevalent for us in the way that people talk about culture is the way that power distances people in the way that we make culture. So we might even think about something like popular culture. Why is it popular? You know, who gave these people the platform to, you know, broadcast their perspective? Well, there is a lot of money behind it. You know, there's powerful interests that are pushing particular ideologies, you know, particular strains of thought and strains of meaning. And so we have to be able to see the way that power distances and the way that power directs the way that we go about our culture making, and the way that that often destroys and dehumanizes image bearers historically and throughout history. And so we have to be sensitive to the way that power works in the relationship of power and culture, while at the same time not allowing power to be the only thing that we see, which is why I have the other four dimensions. But I wanted to get to power as soon as possible because a lot of contemporary accounts of culture center on power, and maybe rightly so, because as sinners, there's been a lot of damage and abuse and things that we have done. But I just wanted to make sure also to say that culture is not just a struggle for power. There is always a struggle to say, you know, even within a culture, whose perspective gets to be in the center, you know?
Yeah.
And culture is pretty diverse and there's dissenting voices, you know? I'm not always happy with the people that are selected to represent the Christian community publicly, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And so, but there's a power element to whose perspective is taken to be normative and who gets to be the spokesman for that. And so power is this dimension that requires for us as Christians a level of iconoclasm to name power and then also to deny any of these powers the sole prerogative to say what is, because that is something that belongs to God alone.
And then the ethical dimension, the third of these five lenses, culture as moral boundary.
That's right. Yeah. So culture as a moral boundary recognizes the way that we naturally build moral communities. Culture is almost always a moral community. And in any community, there's going to be lines and boundaries as far as what is acceptable. We might call those rules or mores or community standards. But there's always going to be certain things that are looked down on as unacceptable and certain things that are valorized. And we can't not do that. We are moral beings. We have a law written on our hearts. We have moral intuitions. And so we are naturally going to organize ourselves in moral communities, which draws lines, right, as far as what's okay and what's not. In this chapter, I'm trying to sort of do the opposite of the previous chapter. If the previous chapter is sort of deconstructive in the sense of exposing power and power's abuse, this chapter is trying to be constructive and say, well, it's not just enough to talk about coercive power and the way that coercive power breaks. We also have to talk about creative power and the way the creative power builds. So power is not necessarily a bad thing. Power is a gift in some sense, as Andy Crouch talks about in his book. Mm-hmm. And we can use power to build these moral communities where we seek the flourishing of those within, and we seek to live well with those who are across the boundary as well.
Then, we're going through these very quickly. People certainly can obtain your book, Interpreting Your World, Five Lenses for Engaging Theology and Culture. The fourth lens, the religious dimension, culture as sacred experience.
Yeah, so there is a sense in every culture, we are religious beings, of course, but even in a secular society, people organize themselves religiously, meaning that they seek experiences that of solidarity that transcend their own individual interest. You can just experience this by going to a baseball game or a football game, you know, and see the way that people will high-five total strangers in this sort of experience of ecstasy, religious ecstasy, or a concert or something like that, and how that's just really natural, not just that we would seek these sacred experiences, but that we would organize communities around them, mm-hmm. right? So you think of fandom itself as a phenomenon is a lot of times a replacement for the church for a lot of people. And so we might want to critique that, but first we have to understand, well, why would people even do that? It's because we are religious beings that naturally seek ways to find transcendence and try to build communities around that transcendence. And so we want to both acknowledge that, but also see the way that Christian faith comes with something from the outside, right? That which we could never have found ourselves, which is the revelation of God in Jesus Christ.
And then the aesthetic dimension, culture as a poetic project.
Yeah, the aesthetic dimension represents this idea of how all of us are trying to make a beautiful life. And beauty might be understood in various ways, but a life that is better, right, for ourselves and for our children. And within culture, there are all sorts of things that we do that we just do, and my phrase is just for the heaven of it, you know, just for the sheer joy of doing it. We build sandcastles, we blow bubbles, you know, we whistle while we work. And that too is a part of our culture making, right? That which we do not for any purpose other than the fact that it brings us joy, because God has poured this joy into the world and has poured delight into the world. And there's this great passage in Zechariah that I quote where Zechariah is describing the new creation, and it is characterized by children playing in the streets. You know, we don't often think about that, but that there is something about culture and our culture making that is characterized by delight and joy. And so I'm asking, is there a way that we can find in that delight and joy and anticipation of the new creation, you know, which is why the phrase just for the heaven of it kind of captures that a bit, because it is in some way an anticipation of what's coming.
Well, help us as we come to the conclusion of our conversation. I know I've got to let you go here in just a moment, but there's been a lot said, and perhaps somebody's just joined us in the last few minutes. And how would you like us to interpret this conversation in terms of your hope for what's been said today, but really your hope for the book?
Yeah, I think one of the main reasons I wrote this book is because it feels to me like a lot of Christian engagement with culture is quite anxious and fearful. And then that often leads to cynicism as well, and then sometimes even a desire to get out of it, withdraw completely. Mm-hmm. And I understand that. I definitely understand that. And there are things that do bring anxiety to us. But I'm hoping to articulate in this book maybe more patient and grounded and non-anxious approach to culture, not because we have nothing to fear in the short term, but because really we have nothing to fear in the long term because of where our confidence ultimately lies.
You've been listening to His People on Pilgrim Radio. Many thanks to our guest, Dr. Justin Bailey, theology professor at Dort University and author of Interpreting Your World.
Coming up on tomorrow's program, it's Megan Allman on what she believes should be priorities for pro-life Christians now that Roe v. Wade has been overturned.
There are many who maybe not as informed on the issue who thought that this victory in the Supreme Court means, oh, we're done. It's done. Mm-hmm. The pro-lifers have won. When in fact, that is not at all what it means. If anything, our work has begun in earnest.
That's tomorrow at this same time right here on His People. Thanks for listening.